From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a photographer artfully documents personal belongings taken from detainees at the U.S.-Mexico border. Then, writer-director Greta Gerwig explains how she made a version of Little Women that felt modern, but also faithful to what so many readers loved about the 1860s novel.
There's a long list of women for whom this book meant very specific freedom and ambition, and what I wanted to do was make a film that was in the tradition of why that inspired them.
All that coming up on The Frame. For more than a decade, photographer Thomas Kiefer worked as a janitor at a Border Patrol station in southern Arizona. He'd often find personal belongings from border crossers that had been confiscated by agents and tossed in the trash. Kiefer began taking photos of the discarded items, and now they're being exhibited. His photography show, currently at the Skirball Center in West L.A., is titled El Sueño Americano. The Frame contributor Marcos Najera has our story.
Two small chairs and two pairs of headphones are stationed in a corner of the gallery. When you slip on the headphones, out comes Gwen Stefani. And even a little Marvin Gaye.
All things and what they lose.
And Maya.
Are you gonna tell me,
While you're listening to the jams, you see a large framed photograph showing rows and rows of CDs on a hot pink background. From salsa to soul, this music belonged to a woman named Cynthia Gallegos Lucas. Photographer Tom Kiefer found her trash collection in southern Arizona. He took a picture of the set and shares it now in his El Sueño Americano show. As for Cynthia, we don't really know. Several years ago, Tom Kiefer ran an antique shop in LA's Silver Lake neighborhood. The likes of Cher and Bette Midler were known to pop in now and again. But when times got tough, he moved to the small border town of Ajo, Arizona. Kiefer took a job as a custodian, cleaning the local U.S. Border Patrol station. It wasn't long before he noticed a troubling trend.
It was summer of 2007 that all this food, perfectly good canned food, was just being thrown away, and it bothered me deeply.
That food belonged to people like Cynthia Gallegos Lucas, trying to make their way across the dangerous Sonoran Desert border. When federal agents capture someone, most, if not all, of their personal belongings, including food, water, clothes, cash, condoms and toys, even fortune cookie papers, are trashed. But Tom Kiefer says it wasn't always that way in Ajo.
When I started working at the station, one of my first memories was of the agents collecting the food and taking it to our local food bank. And then there was a change of leadership. And when the head chief found out what was going on with the food, he put an immediate halt to that. I mean, there are people out there to arrest.
And that is how it all started.
I couldn't take it anymore. And so I went to one of the supervisors, and I said, hey, can I bring this food to the food bank? And his exact words to me were, bless you.
But when Kiefer would sift through the trash bins to pull out the food, he started finding lots more than canned tuna.
Oh my God, there's a Bible here. There's a rosary. There's a family photograph. It just instinctively struck me as this is not right. So whenever I would see something like that, I would just put it in with the box where I put the food.
He'd smuggle out larger, bulkier items, like backpacks and blankets, in big trash bags.
Shoes, the jeans, anything that was considered non-essential or potentially lethal was taken away, confiscated, and then just thrown in the trash.
I met up with Kiefer recently in Phoenix to learn more about his work. We're at a frame shop where he's getting some prints finished for upcoming shows and for clients like Chapman University in Orange County. Kiefer had not initially planned on taking pictures of the personal treasures from the trash, but here in Phoenix, he brainstormed with fellow artists and shared some test shots.
I have to admit, I was one of the skeptical people. I thought, they're a little too designy.
Liz Allen is head curator at Northlight Gallery in Phoenix.
But I knew, because I've seen this happen before, you see early work of someone and you realize, oh, this is going somewhere.
Eventually, Allen featured Kiefer's growing body of work at Northlight. That show caught the eye of LA's Skirball Center, and the rest is history. But far away from the pristine halls of high-end galleries is the harsher reality of the people who owned the objects in Kiefer's pictures. Right before I met the photographer in Phoenix, I went to a gathering where people were writing Christmas cards for migrant families who were incarcerated at immigration detention centers here in the Phoenix area.
The least we can do is send them a little card and let them know that at least we're still thinking about them.
Esther Duran Lum is with a refugee aid group called Uncaged and Reunite Families. She works directly with the people that most of us can only imagine when we look at Tom Kiefer's pictures. I showed her some of his photos, including one of a single eyelash curler.
It's just a little something to say, you know what? I still care about myself. I care how I look. I haven't lost my identity.
Duran Lum was also struck by the portrait of dozens of confiscated cell phones. She says the picture tells only part of the story of someone seeking asylum, so she fills in the rest.
When the court would send them a message to their cell phone that, you know, their court date was such and such, they're never going to get it. They have no phone. They have nothing. So they miss it, and then they say, okay, you're not eligible.
Esther Duran Lum suggests I take Tom Kiefer to visit the Refugee Welcome Center near the Phoenix airport before he heads back to Ajo.
Our team will guide him through the ropa room.
You're saying ropa, like clothes?
Ropa, like clothes, yes.
We quickly realize Kiefer connects with people when they're stripped of their belongings. Here, new versions of those items are restored. That is, at least for those lucky enough to make it this far.
I keep on discovering things. I realize now, oh my God, that pair of coveralls, someone who worked as a mechanic or, I mean, el sueño americano.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Thomas Kiefer's exhibition is at the Skirball Center through March 8th. Coming up on The Frame, how Greta Gerwig willed herself onto the remake of Little Women. There's a new film adaptation of Little Women on its way to theaters. Writer-director Greta Gerwig's take on Louisa May Alcott's 1860s novel comes out on Christmas Day, and yes, you should take the family. In this version of the beloved story, the March sisters, Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, are played by Emma Watson, Saoirse Ronan, Eliza Scanlon, and Florence Pugh. Laura Dern plays their mother, and Meryl Streep is their wealthy Aunt March. Even before she knew that film producer Amy Pascal was developing a new adaptation of Little Women, Greta Gerwig had thoughts about how she'd tell the story on film. Her connection to the book started a long time ago.
Little Women has been a book that I have loved my whole life in a very deep way, to the point where my memories and the memories of the March sisters were intertwined. In that way that I think books of your youth can mean something even beyond being books, because they become part of your family. I think that's the magic of reading when you're a child, is that the distinction between fiction and reality is thin for you, or it was for me anyway. But I hadn't read it since I was about 14 or 15, and then I read it in my early 30s, I think when I turned 30. And I... all this stuff came out at me in the book that it had not when I was a child.
When I get in a passion, I get so savage. I could hurt anyone, and I'd enjoy it.
You remind me of myself.
But you're never angry.
I'm angry nearly every day of my life.
Reading it as an adult, I heard all of these different things. I saw it as much spikier and sadder and stranger and almost more triumphant in a certain way. And also just this kind of being aware of an author was another layer of it for me, that Joe both wants to be an author, but then Louisa as author. And so even though Joe March, by the end of the book, says she stops up her ink well and stops writing and, you know, gets married and has children and opens a school, that Louisa, though, wrote, and she wrote that book, and we know it because there's the book. You know, I just sort of had an idle thought about, well, if I made this, I'd want to center on this. I'd want to center on all these themes that I felt I hadn't really seen yet about it, which was ambition and money and women and art. And I heard in passing, my agent said at a dinner, oh, they're interested in making Little Women again. And I was like, wait, what? I have to go talk to them. I have an idea. And I hadn't made anything at that point, but he got me a meeting, and I went and I talked to them and I told them some version of what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to direct it. And they, I want to write in, I want to direct it. And I had nothing to really show that I could do that. So, but they very luckily hired me to write it. And then I wrote my draft in 2015, 2016, and then I went away and I made Lady Bird. And then by the time I was finishing that up, they said, well, what do you think about making Little Women? And I said, well, I knew you'd ask. I'm ready. but it was one of those fortuitous turns of events.
I want to ask about that perspective that you had of reading the book as an adult versus as a young woman.
Sure.
And the perspective you have as somebody who is a creative person,
yes,
writing movies and
yes,
making movies.
Yes.
Because so much of the movie, and it's certainly in the book as well, is about the challenges of being a creative person and how you value your own art, how you compromise with the
yes,
people who are financing it, and how you find your voice even in those parameters.
That's right. No, there's a you picked up all the cards I put down. No, it's funny. It's that the opening scene between Jo March and her publisher, Mr. Dashwood, which the majority of it is actually word for word from the book, when she says, I took care to have a few of my sinners repent. And he says, people want to be amused, not preached at. Morals don't sell nowadays. That could be me talking to a studio head about something I want to do. It was all there for me to be discovered. I didn't invent it. Like I said, that scene is a scene from the book. But it felt just so relevant to right now. And then beyond that, when I was researching Louisa May Alcott, and it became clear that who Louisa May Alcott was equally the subject that I was interested in. And it was the subject I was interested in because it's embedded in the book.
You mind yourself, dearie. Someday you'll need me, and you'll wish you had behaved better.
Thank you, Aunt March, for your employment and your many kindnesses, but I intend to make my own way in the world.
Oh, well, no one makes their own way. Not really. Least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
But you are not married, Aunt March.
Well, that's because I'm rich.
And then when you learn about her life is, you know, unlike Joe, she never got married, she never had children, but she kept writing. And she did keep her copyright of Little Women, which is a, you know, a huge thing that she did. And, I mean, there were so many things about her life and what she did that felt eerily familiar. And I think even in the fact that her publisher... And even herself, but her publisher truly didn't know what a hit he had. And I find that happens all the time, that there's a constant underestimating of audiences that are not the same audience of the people who are in charge of publishing or whatever that may be.
The first half of Little Women,
yes,
because
yes,
it is really two books as written, ends so grouped the curtain falls upon Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy. Whether it ever rises again depends upon the reception given to the first act of the domestic drama called Little Women.
Yes.
It's almost like she's saying, I've got a sequel, but I hope people buy the first
That's
version.
Right. No, she's a business lady. No, she it's worth saying the initial printing sold out in 2 weeks, and it has not been out of print for 150 years.
In 1984, there was a story, Little Women leads poll, novel rated ahead of Bible for influence on high school pupils.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, it's just nice for her.
It's great for her. And it raises this other question of like what people take away from the book, because you can interpret it in very different ways. And I'm going to give you two prominent women who have thoughts about it. The first is Gloria Steinem, who said in 1992, "Where else could we have read about an all-female group who discussed work, art, and all the great questions, or found girls who wanted to be women and not vice versa?"
Oh, that's beautiful. Found girls that wanted to be women. That's
and
nice.
Not vice versa. And here's the author, Camille Paglia, who says, the whole thing is like a horror movie to me.
I know. That take is, there's two books as published. There's, you know, this first book that is, I think what, if you have an idea in your head of the iconography of Little Women, it's usually from the first book. It's the kind of Christmas to Christmas structure. And the second half of the book, Louisa May Alcott joked she should have called the wedding marches because they all got married. And truly,
the British version is called Good Wives.
Exactly. So, you know, it was in this two book structure, which is part of why I structured the film as I did, starting with them as adults, because I wanted to start with the second half. But I also think there's two books embedded in it, because if you just read the book on its face value with this kind of pre-Victorian morality of, domesticity and virtue tied to femininity and all of these, you know, these kind of tidy bows put on each chapter, then I think you miss what's really roiling underneath. And if you read it that way, of course, Camille Paglia is completely right. It is something that would be a horror show if that is all you're seeing. But the way I look at it is, if you can take the ending of the book where she felt she must marry Joe off to someone because that's what the readers demanded, and she made this economic decision that that's what she would do because she had to sell books, then if you read everything through the lens of, well, she had to make it all kind of tidy for the time, then if you just take away the tidiness, what's left is a whole bunch of ambition and mess and anger and lust and craziness and things that don't fit neatly into any box. And so what I wanted to do was not update the text. The text doesn't need updating. I wanted to take away the constraints of the time in some ways, because that's what was interesting to me. And even in those constraints, Louisa really did do her best to try to imagine what would an egalitarian marriage look like? What would something that was not essentially indentured servitude be as a marriage? And I feel that, you know, Gloria Steinem being one of them, but whether Simone de Beauvoir or Patti Smith or Elena Ferrante or J.K. Rowling, there's a long list of women for whom this book meant very specific freedom and ambition. And what I wanted to do was make a film that was in the tradition of why that inspired them. Because there's gotta be a reason more than she got married to Professor Bear.
Up next on The Frame, more of my conversation with filmmaker Greta Gerwig. She explains how a pivotal scene in Little Women was influenced by a sketch on Saturday Night Live. Let's get back now to my conversation with Greta Gerwig, the screenwriter and director of Little Women. Saoirse Ronan plays Jo March in the film. She also starred in Gerwig's 2017 directing debut, Lady Bird, which brought them both Oscar nominations. With Little Women, Gerwig says, she and Ronan both felt incredibly close to the story.
We had a kind of mystical connection with the material, with the book, with the character of Joe, and with the person of Louisa May Alcott. And I remember the day on set when we were doing this long push-in on Saoirse, and she just suddenly sat in this particular way and cocked her head in a particular way. And I almost gasped because I thought, oh my God, that's Joe. That's Joe March. And then we rolled out and I ran out from the other side of the camera, and then she looked at me and she just said, I know, I know. And I thought, oh my God, you know, it's like Joe came. Joe came to play with us. So I feel like the connection that I have with Saoirse is so deep in that we both were waiting for the person to arrive that was Joe/Louisa, and then she came. And it's both of us, and it's neither of us.
I'm going to play you a video, which doesn't really translate well onto radio, but you're going to watch it, and you're going to know why it's important.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. We're watching Steve Martin and Gilda Radner dancing together on Saturday Night Live, and it's one of my favorite things on television or film. And in a way, this was, oh my God, I love it. It makes me laugh and cry every time I see it. But this is something I showed Timothy and Saoirse when they did their dance outside the Gardener party. And this was an inspiration for it. And it's like a combination of like a kind of, it sort of looks like a Sid Charisse, Gene Kelly dance number that then they go into this silly dancing, which is amazing. And I have to say, it makes me laugh because it's very funny, and it also makes me cry in the way I would hope maybe people, if they go see Little Women, would cry, because Gilda's gone, and she was one of the greatest ever. And I think when I see it, I feel that, like, you know, that her funniness, her humanity, her beauty, her elegance, her, you know, taking the piss out of herself all at once. And I think we're the lesser for her passing. And I think in some ways that's also what I wanted to capture in Little Women with this structure of we start when they're adults, and really those four sisters are never all together again, which they don't know that they'll never all be together again. And I think, I don't know, that ache, but I feel it when I watch that. Isn't it one of the best things ever put to film?
It's great. The idea is that they're confined by a dance style that is prescribed by the music.
Yes.
And they start doing crazy dance because they're not going to be limited by what everybody else wants them to do. In some ways, that's not only a good definition of what you want to do with Little Women, but also that idea that you can take something that looks formal and make it fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think also what I love about that and what I wanted to play with in this is when you have a shared signifiers and shared iconography, you can have a lot of fun playing with how you want to shift off of that or comment on it while it's happening. And so one of the great pleasures for me as a filmmaker making this is these signifiers and this iconography of Little Women, of gathered around the fireplace, reading the letter from Father. I have to have that, and I want to have it, and I want it to be as beautiful as we all remember. And then also, it's gone. It exists in Joe's memory. So being able to kind of do that, and even, you know, the big romantic ending of, like, I got to have, you know, rain machines and a camera on a crane. And when I was working with Alexandre and saying, write the cymbal crash, I want
this
it.
This is you know? Your composer, Alexandre Desplat.
Yes, yes. And then I get to twist it. So it was always like I was getting to play with what is so iconic about the book and then what is the filmmaking language we've ascribed to these kinds of stories. And then how can I introduce something different, which is what this clip does exactly. So it's funny. I mean, I guess I could say I was really heavily influenced by this SNL sketch, but I do. I think, you know, you never know where your inspiration comes from. And that, I remember being shown that when I was a child, and it really made an impact on me because I loved those Gene Kelly movies. So I knew exactly what they were referencing, and I knew exactly why it was funny.
I'm going to ask you one last question.
Sure.
I remember seeing a tweet when the trailer came out, and a woman said, "This is my Star Wars."
Oh, that's so lovely.
And it's really lovely, but it also means it's kind of also important that you come out a week after Star Wars, but that this movie and this book means so much to so many people. And I guess it sounds like a superhero line with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes, it's scary.
About what this book means to so many people and how you honor that and then make it something new and that is yours.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's a responsibility I felt, which is why when I was writing it and preparing to direct it, I really had a I had a real long talk with myself in the woods about whether or not I was up to it, because I don't come at this material lightly, and I don't come at people's love of it lightly. And it's something that I needed to do for myself in the way that I understood the material, that I was hearing the material anew, and that I was honoring everybody's collective love and memory of it. So it's a balancing. And I mean, in a way, it's not unlike Star Wars in that this memory you have of a child, and then how do you honor that and then do something new? And by the way, I mean, I also do love Star Wars. So I feel like we can have it, all of it.
Greta, so good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. That was really fun.
Little Women opens on Christmas Day, and that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.